That's during December, then.
Yeah. No, I think it's really worthwhile to take the time to go through it again. So we'll go so much faster afterwards if we have some review.
I'm going through it.
I thought 4 months ahead of me. No problem. Began to collapse real quick in zero time.
Mm-hmm. That's precisely why.
You know, people say, "Well, I won't take a free class. I'll just learn it on my own and get the book." And
if I ever see somebody do it, I'm gonna shout from the housetops. You know, but we're just too busy of people. There's too many things.
Memorized paradigms.
Yeah, it does. When you don't have to when you don't have to take a test, you know, it's a good old motive of just plain fear. Judgment seems to ultimately come. Yeah, right.
Also, we need to be encouraging one another.
Yeah, yeah. That helps a lot. It helps to have other guys going through it with you.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Find out that they're doing as poorly as you are.
What's that? Yeah, right. Yeah, right. I don't have to anymore. At least not to take a test.
Then we can't do those
who
can't keep.
Yeah. Right. No. You just learn to be real practical after a while and use your memory load for what's going to count and not for what things that won't. I find I remember most everything just without working at it, except for the real exceptional ones. The ones that, you know, once you get into all the holovers and all that stuff, I don't know anybody, unless you spoke the language, that would remember them, and even then they probably wouldn't be aware that they remembered them. They'd be just doing that out of habit. That's the only way you could learn a language like this, to speak it. Just have it, you know, be plunged into an environment where it becomes habit. Okay, I'll trust the roll sheet. Well, we left off in chapter 3, talking about adjectives in a review here. Just some reminders here. We looked at the endings on adjectives. We basically have four forms for the adjective. We actually have a paradigm here for the feminine and for the masculine, for the singular and plural. So you've got two numbers and two genders to be concerned about. That gives you four possible forms. And we see this propretonic reduction system occurring again here when you have a disyllabic adjective that gets an ending that makes it trisyllabic, and you get a propretonic reduction. So gadol becomes gidolat when you put the feminine ending on it, and you reduce the comments to schwa. So he's discussing that here. The forms of katon are unusual in that there is a different stem before the ending. So you have katon, but then you have katana, and you get a pathak there instead of a cholam on that second syllable. That's the unusual thing. Katanim, katanot, same thing. So he's just throwing a few of these irregularities at you here. Then we look at these monosyllabic adjectives. A relatively small group show the following typical forms. The principles underlying the change in the stem will be discussed in a later lesson. So, and we did talk about that later, but we won't get to it right now. Here we see rab, or rav, meaning many, and then rabah, and you get the doubling. You get the dagesh there, and you get a doubling of that thing. Rabim and raboth. So there's a doubling of that second consonant all the way through. With mar, that can't take dagesh, but you do get mara, the comments say, you get marim, maroth. Ra, meaning evil, same pattern as mar. Az, you get the azah with the dagesh and the zayin. And azim and azoth. Chai, you get chaya with the dagesh and the yod, because yod is a consonantal yod here. And so chayim, and then, excuse me, chaya, chayim, and chayoth. Dal, you get the dala, and you get the dagesh and the lamas there again. So that's the main feature there. The things that can take a dagesh get a dagesh in these monosyllabic adjectives on that last stem before the ending. And aside from that, they're pretty straightforward. Then the adjectives ending in e, the sagol hey, have the following forms. Yafeh. And then we have yafa, yafim, yafoth. So for the feminine, instead of adding another hey to it, it's already got a hey on the end. So you don't add another hey to it, but there is a change in the vowel point. So from Yafet becomes Yafa. Now, obviously, if you didn't have vowel points, there wouldn't be any distinction between those two forms, and you'd have to tell by context. And Yafim and Yafoth. It must have been interesting in their reading, you know, to read something, to see those things, and they would have to know whether you're talking about a man or a woman in order to know how to pronounce it, whether to say Yafa or Yafet, you know, and I'm sure that all came as part of the habits.
Well, the noun before
would tip you off. Well, usually, but sometimes the adjective may follow, well, the noun would, but sometimes if the adjective is preceding the noun, then, you know, you haven't seen the noun yet, you know. And so, of course, your eye would probably just put them all together and do it that way. It's interesting to try to speculate on what it might be to grow up learning this language. Kasher becomes kasha, kashim, kasho. Same thing, meaning hard or difficult. So I think you remember that. Use of the adjectives, a little bit on the syntax. And this, I think, would be worth reviewing a little bit because it's real basic and it's important to other syntax later on. We find the same kind of thing we find in Greek. We have attributive and predicate positions for adjectives, but we don't have quite the detailed structure that Greek has as far as those positions are concerned. First of all, an attributive adjective he talks about is one that unites, the adjective becomes one phrase with the noun that it modifies, and they function together in the sentence. And so, as far as forms are concerned, the attributive adjective in Hebrew follows its noun and agrees with it in number, gender, and definiteness. So if you want to make something attributive to the adjective, to a noun, you put the adjective after the noun, and then you also make sure that it agrees in number, gender, and definiteness. So in addition to number and gender that we have in Greek, we also have definiteness. There's going to be an agreement in definiteness. If the noun in Hebrew has the article, the adjective that is attributive to it will have the article. If the noun in Hebrew is anarthrous, the adjective will also be anarthrous. So we see some examples here. Ish tov, a good man. Anarthrous, ish, followed by tov, an adjective, also anarthrous, and it's an attributive adjective. Ha ish ha tov, the good man. So here we see again the article on the noun, but it's also on the adjective. It's going to agree there. If you don't make that concord, you'll run into predicate positions down here. So that's the reason. They are using this grammatical device to make the difference. So we want to make sure that the adjective is agreeing with the noun in definiteness. And then a plural, anashim, tovim, good men, and ha-anashim, ha-tovim, the good men. Some feminines, isha, tova, a good woman, ha-isha, ha-tova, the good woman. Nashim tovoth, good women, and ha-nashim, ha-tovoth, the good women. Why do we have a difference in the ending on nashim and tovoth? How come it's not tovim?
Isha is irregular.
Right, takes a regular plural, and it's still feminine, even though it's got an im plural. And that femininity is reflected in the adjective. The adjective will be consistently oath for feminine nouns, regardless of the ending on the feminine noun. So you have a consistency with adjectives, whereas you don't have with nouns. The nouns, like you say, are, you know, some are irregular, and they will, if you want to call them irregular, they will take im for, a feminine noun may take an im plural, or a masculine noun may take an oath plural. And it's generally very common words that are the most irregular. You know, like words like father is very common. It's avos instead of avim and so forth. But the adjective is always going to be consistent. And it's always, and sometimes you can tell, you know, when all else fails, if you've got an adjective, you can tell what you're looking at as far as gender. Okay, do you have anything to add to that, Eric? Or is that what you're going to bring?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Ir gedolah, there's a situation where it's a feminine noun, ir, even though it doesn't have an ah ending or an s or an ah. So, but it's reflected in the adjective that goes with it, and those are easy to forget. So easy to forget. How many times have we seen ir gedol or something like that, and you just forget that it's feminine. So, it's really important to do that. Ha ir ha gedolah. Arim, Gidoloth, etc. And there again, Arim is an im plural, even though it's a feminine noun, and so your femininities can be reflected in the adjective, Gidoloth. Okay, note that the adjective agrees with the gender of the preceding noun and not with its ending. So that's just what we've been illustrating. It's going to agree with the gender, but not necessarily with the ending. Many times it'll agree with the ending also. In the majority of cases it probably will, but there will be exceptions. Now we get to what we call a predicate position. A juxtaposed noun, an articleless or anarthrous adjective, usually constitute a predication. The adjective being taken as the predicate of the noun and the noun as the subject. Now, juxtaposed means that you just put them together, put them side by side. So you put a noun side by side with an anarthrous adjective, and you'll have a predication. In the predicate function, the adjective may stand before or after its noun subject. There is agreement in number and gender, but the predicate adjective does not, by definition, have the definite article. So the predicate adjective will never have the definite article. The noun may or may not have the article, but in order to be in a predicate position, the adjective cannot have the article. Otherwise, it becomes attributive. Okay, now, examples here, we have tov ha'ish. There, the adjective is in front, and it's anarthrous, and the article is on the noun, so it's the man, he is good. Or you could also say it ha'ish tov. So the word order is variable there, unlike with the attributive. With the attributive, the adjective will always follow, but in the predicate position, it may become before or after, and it will never have the article. The adjective itself will never have it. So both of those are ways of saying the man is good. And there's a slightly different emphasis on these two, too. Yeah, when you have the opportunity for a variable word order, the criteria for deciding what the word order is going to be the way the person feels and how he feels to say it, which is going to be reflected in the emphasis that he's putting on things. So he'll generally put emphasis on the things that said first. So if you want to say the man is good, they'd probably say ha'ish tov. They want to say the man is good. Good is the man, you see. They'll say tov ha'ish.
Mm-hmm. Would there be anything wrong in English if we said good is the man?
Oh, nothing. It's just a little awkward, I suppose. In poetry, you do see that quite frequently, that they'll reword it and so forth. And I don't object to it so much because I kind of like you to think in the Hebrew pattern and then even transfer that over into English. Not that you should speak that way every day in your normal language, you know, but I mean in the context of these of a Hebrew passage or something. Okay. Then the feminines, tova ha'isha, or ha'isha tova, same thing. Plurals, tovim, ha'anashim, or tovoth ha'anashim. The women are good. You see the same situation. Okay, now, a series of adjectives may occur in either function. So you're not limited to only having one adjective modify a noun or one adjective occupying a predicate position. You can string them together, and you do that with the conjunction wa, which they really haven't, he hasn't really developed yet. But we see ha'ir ha'gedolah v'ha'tovah. If you want to say the great and good city. So ha'ir ha'gedolah v'ha'tovah. It's just stringing two adjectives together now. So literally it's the city, the great, and the good. That's kind of the way they're thinking of it. Or ha'ir gedolah v'tovah, the city is great and good. Now you have a predicate position because you have no articles on the adjectives, but now you have a compound adjective modifying. And you could string them together ad infinitum if you wanted to. Okay, then an adjective may be modified by a prepositional phrase in the predicate usage. So if you have an adjective that's a predicate adjective, it's kind of isolated in a sense. It kind of stands by itself by even being in a predicate position. And so it can also take prepositional phrases modifying it. So here's one, Tova ha'ir la'am, the city is good for the people. So here, the city is good is your basic phrase, and then the phrase for the people is added to that, modifying that adjective good. It's giving you some quality to the adjective good. So Tova ha'ir la'am. Now, there may be some ambiguity in some situations, though, as to whether the prepositional phrase is modifying the adjective or the noun. In other words, a person might think of good is the city for the people. In other words, the for the people city is good. And you would have to go by context to try to decide an issue like that. And you wouldn't necessarily go by proximity, because in this case, la'am is closer to ha'ir than it is to tova. And yet, the context makes it pretty clear that it's the city is good for the people. It's good for the people. It's a good for the people kind of city. Okay? But there can be some debate about some of those situations. Then, when a subject noun is indefinite, there's a chance of ambiguity. This you can probably deduce from what we've said already. In the case where you have a predicate position and the noun has the article and the adjective doesn't, there's no question that it's a predicate position. When you have a situation where you have a noun and an adjective, neither of which have the article, now you can potentially have an ambiguity. Is it predicate or is it attributive position? Because now they happen to both agree, and so that's what you need for attributive. But by the same token, the only requirement for a predicate position is to have the article, the adjective not have the article, so it could qualify for that too. Again, context comes to your rescue, and you have to rely on that. So chokhmah tova could be good wisdom, or wisdom is good. It wouldn't be the wisdom is good, but it'd be wisdom is good, and without the article. So again, it says this is uncommon and can usually be resolved from the context. All right, then adjectives may be used as nouns. That's the same thing we've seen in Greek, substantives we call them, where an adjective is functioning like a noun, and it can happen two ways in Hebrew. Either it can happen as a person, and something is personified, you know, somebody who does a certain thing or is a certain thing as a person can be characterized by taking the adjective and putting the article on it and making it function like a noun. Usually with a definite article, although context can sometimes do that too. But the adjective, usually with a definite article, may mean the one who is. So, he-chacham would be the wise one or the wise man. Putting the article on the word chacham, an adjective, and be the wise one or the wise man. Or secondly, both the masculine and the feminine forms of some adjectives may be used as abstract nouns, meaning that which is something. And you're likely to see this both with masculine and feminine. I don't know which would be the predominant one. With more conceptual things, there seems to be a preponderance for use of the feminine, something like that. But I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. But it seems to favor more feminine. Feminine thing. Often concepts, you know, things like love or beauty or you know this kind of thing are often feminine nouns in Hebrew. And it'd be an interesting study sometimes to characterize nouns that are masculine and feminine to see what kind of basic categories they line up in. But you might see it either way. Like, for example, you might see hara or hara'a for evil or wickedness. Okay. Eric, did you have...
There was a discussion at the NI6 if wonderful counselor, if that should be wonderful, there should be attributed.
Oh, yes, right.
Or just function like a noun.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be, from the truth of his thinking, it will be kind of when Mark suggests it should be standing like as a noun wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth, his roots will seem kind of unusual, but it stands as a noun.
What is the situation such that both of them are anarthrous?
Yeah.
That's probably the reasoning there. It is ambiguous, so yeah. it could go either way. Does the adjective precede, is wonderful ahead of the noun or behind the noun in Hebrew?
Ahead.
It's ahead of it. Okay. Yeah. That would tend to lean it in favor of that, because see normally an attributive adjective will follow the noun. And so if it's out in front, the predicate will either be out in front or behind. But the attributive will be following it. So that's another thing that you can use to tell. I would say it was almost certainly that. It'd be very unusual to have an attributive adjective standing in front. Unless there was some real bizarre reason poetically or something for it. Okay. That's the end of that chapter. Lesson 4. Noun plurals continued, and that kept continuing and continuing and continuing. several of the categories of nouns in plurals, these ones, this next type, have some that are subject to pretonic reduction. So it's two nouns, nouns of two syllables whose first syllable is either closed or contains an unchangeable long vowel, in which case it can't reduce. You see, those are the two conditions that prevent it from being reduced. It's either closed already, it's got a short closed syllable, or it's got an unchangeable long vowel. So you can't reduce it. And you want to reduce something. Whose second syllable is either comets or tseri, the two guys that are likely to get shortened, form their plurals in two ways. That'd be nice if they always just had pretonic reduction, but they don't. The first syllable remains unchanged, but in the second, tseri is reduced to shua, while comets is generally retained. Again, generally, so we always have a loophole. The following nouns illustrate the most important types. So, but a general observation about these, and that's about all you can do in some of these nouns. See, what they're trying to do is the nouns form the plurals, and they just form the plurals the way they form them. And what we're trying to do is categorize them into groups to try to remember how they do it. And so that's what this is all about. So first, if you've got a closed syllable in the first syllable, you have examples like mishpat, you have hirik in the first syllable, you have shawa there, it's closed. And then you start in the last syllable, mishpat, and you've got a comments there. According to this, you would expect a pretonic reduction here of the comments, but it doesn't happen. The comments generally stays the same, so you get mishpatim. And so nothing really has happened except adding an im to it. Malak, same thing, malakim. And mizbeach, there you have a tseri in the second syllable. And the patak furtiv, we don't worry about for this purpose. For these purposes, that just goes away once you put the ending on. But that tseri does reduce to shua. So you get mizbechov. And you reduce down to shua there for that one. So tseri will reduce, comments won't under those circumstances. Next category is similar in that you have an unchangeable long vowel in the first syllable, and for the same reason it can't shorten. The first two examples here are with tseri. So you get oyev, meaning enemy, becomes oyevim. And notice that tseri has in fact reduced to shua. Kohen, becomes kohanim. That has also reduced to shua, but of course it has to be a chatef. Pathak, because you're on a guttural. Then kokav, though, becomes kokavim, and that similar situation, unchangeable long in the first, and the comments in the second, but the comments does not shorten. And hey chal, same thing, hey chalim. Okay, then a special situation is encountered in a few words, such as iwer. It's got a tseri there, and it's got a short syllable in the first, but what happens is on this one, you might the wow there is doubled. It's not a shurek, it's a doubled wow. In fact, for review, how can you tell in this aware that that's not a double, not a shurek? Yeah, and so I got another vowel point on it. See, it's if it was a shurek, it would be a vowel, but because it's got the tseri under it, you know it's a doubled wow. But then when they put it in the plural, they take the dagesh out, and mainly, I think, just to shorten the word so you don't have see, if you left the dot gauge in, the shua would have to be vocal. And because of, you have, whenever something's double, it's a vocal shua, because in effect you've got two of them. You've got one closing the first syllable and one starting next. So they take it out just for, apparently, to streamline the word a little bit. So it becomes ilrim. And kisei, same thing, you have a dagesh in the somic there, but that is eliminated, and it becomes kisot instead of kisot, which it would be if it had the dagesh in it. Okay, so some of that is just for the purpose of streamlining the word, I'm sure. All right, the active participle. This was the first kind of a verb form we ever encountered in Hebrew, and we used it, got a lot of mileage out of those for a while. We're making a lot of sentences just with participles. And, of course, there's a lot more development of the concept of participles later on. His first section here, he does a little bit of discussion of the concept of roots in Hebrew and the idea of certain three consonant groups that are forming consistent patterns. And so he relates that to the concept of a root, although he does give a little bit of caution lest you think that the idea of a root involves some evolutionary process where all of a sudden some word comes out of nowhere and it has a root and then all the other words evolve from it. It's not really the picture. We don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know. All we know is that looking at a set of forms, we can see a common pattern to those forms. And generally, grammatically speaking, we pick the simplest form possible to call that our root. That's why your third person masculine singular verb form is the one that's used in the dictionaries, because it's the shortest and the simplest, got no endings on it, no other stuff on it, you see. That's just kind of, and that's why it's called a root. Doesn't necessarily mean that was the way the word originated when it was given at the Tower of Babel or something, or wherever things originated in that respect. Okay, so I think that's a good observation, but we can, it's all right to think in terms of a concept of root, just don't think in terms of an evolutionary development. All right? Now, he begins to look at a certain vowel pattern, though. In addition to these consonant patterns, there are certain vowel patterns, and most of the time the vowels change enough so that you don't see a real good pattern. You have them all changing within a paradigm. But in the case of the participle, you do see a consistent, relatively consistent pattern. So the vowel pattern he's introducing here says, but consider the following set of words. Kofev, meaning riding, Holek, meaning walking or going, Yoshev, meaning sitting, and Yorev, meaning descending. All of them have O-A, a Cholom Seri pattern. And it says that the vowel pattern Cholom Seri is a regular one for the formation of the active participle with roots of the triconsonantal type illustrated. Thus, while it is always analytically legitimate to isolate roots and formative patterns, one must exercise caution about assigning specific meaning to the latter. We shall begin our study of the Hebrew verb with the participial form mentioned above. The participle is in nearly all respects an adjective so far as its syntax and inflection are concerned. And so participles, even in Greek, a participle is defined as a verbal adjective. And so we see the same kind of thing happening here. It's a thing that is acting like an adjective, but also like a verb. It's got verbal action, but it's also has attributive aspects and so forth. And so it functions like an adjective. And the paradigm of one is just like an adjective. So you have Yoshev, and then the plural is Yoshevim, which follows Pretonic reduction, just because of the got unchangeable long first syllable and the seri in the second syllable, so it's just like some of those adjectives that we've seen earlier, some of the words, the plurals we've seen earlier. Then the feminine, Yosheveth, that's a little bit unusual. You might have expected Yosheva or something, but it becomes Yosheveth, and you get a segulate form for this feminine. And then Yoshevoth is pretty straightforward. So, the first vowel is unchangeable long, the vowel of the second syllable is stereo, therefore changeable. Note the feminine form with F and a corresponding change in the vowel of the final stem syllable. The form Yosheva is also found, but less frequently. So, there will be a form Yosheva that's possible. And that's kind of like, you know, now that you've been looked further ahead and we've looked at some of the other forms, infinitives and things like that, infinitive constructs and so forth, we've run into these same kinds of segulate patterns again. And sometimes we run into words that'll both have a segulate pattern and have this other pattern. So that will become more common in the future. Okay, the participle may be used attributively. So ha'ish ha'kotheh would be the writing man or the man who is writing. So we're attributing a verbal action to the man now. Just like, you know, you could say a good man, now we're saying a writing man, the man who's writing. So you can see that function real clearly there as far as the participle is concerned. Or you can use a predicate in the predicate sense, ha'ish kotheh, the man is writing. So you want to make an assertion about an action he's performing, you can say the man is writing. And this is one of the ways that they get a progressive aspect out of the Hebrew. With the few verb forms they've got, you know, just the perfect and the imperfect, to get a real clear, unambiguous progressive aspect, this is the way to do it with the participle, present participle. So the participle as an attribute and as a predicate usually indicates continuing action, one in progress, and is best translated with the English progressive tenses. Tense, as in the adjectival sentences of the preceding lesson, must be gained from the context. The participial sentences in the exercise should be translated in the present tense or in the immediate future, he is going to or is about to. And there will, again, you have to rely on the context. The man is writing versus the man was writing. The distinction is largely a matter of context and so forth, and the whole situation, what kind of narrative you've been involved in and all that. So for our purposes, though, it's best just to go ahead and use the present. Okay, so here's an example. Ha'ish nofein lechem la'layla, lokimi la'dala. The man is giving or is going to give bread to the poor woman. Okay, what would that dala be there? Kind of a construction. Kind of describe where that word came from. La da la.
Did they have a noun, dal, meaning poor?
Yes, or as an adjective. An adjective, dal, meaning poor, right. And then we've put feminine ending on that and put an article in effect on it with the preposition and made it function as a substantive. So what's happening, that's why it said poor woman. The word woman isn't really there. But it's dala, you see, it becomes poor woman. Because it's the adjective dal in the feminine form. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, good old object marker F, the thing that gets left out more frequently than almost anything else by accident. When the direct object of a verb is a definite noun, and that is if it's got the article or if it's a proper name, or another situation, you know, where it's easy to forget is when you get into construct relationships. And the thing that's in construct is going to get its definiteness from the thing in the absolute at the end of the series. And you can, if you're not watching all the way to the end, you can forget, you know, and not put the F on and so forth. So That's coming quite a bit later. But the if the definite noun is if the noun is definite, I should say, and if it's the direct object, it's preceded by the object marker F. Without makef, so sometimes you'll see it with makef, sometimes without. And without, it's going to be eighth, we'll have a long theory, and with it's going to have f, and it'll be shorter because it's becoming one accentual unit with the rest of it. So we want to double guard our mind and try to remember to make sure the f is there when it needs to be, and it's not there when it doesn't need to be. Ha'ish shomer es ha'torah, the man is observing the law. Okay, we have a noun, ha'ish, the man, with a participle in the predicate position because there's no article on it. And so the man is observing, and then the direct object, F, ha, Torah. So we want the F in there. Now, if it were the man is observing law and you didn't have the article there, then it would just, there would be need, any need for F. It would be just ha'ish shomer Torah. But when the object is definite, And that's true whether it's got the article or it's a proper name. Next example, Ha'am Ohev Es Dawid, the people of David. Okay, Dawid doesn't have an article on it, but it's a proper name, and so that makes it definite. Okay, but if the object is indefinite, it's not marked. Ha'ish Kosev Davar, the man is writing a word. F may be repeated before each member of a compound object. It says may be repeated. That's normally the pattern that it's repeated. Apparently there are exceptions to that, and you just have to kind of keep your eyes for them, open for them. But ha'anashim shomerim F ha'torah ve'F ha'mitzvot. You're going to see more often the F repeated than not repeated, but as we go through the text, we'll have to keep our eyes open for that. Sometimes you don't even notice it because you're just drawing the meaning. You're not really stopping to think whether the F is there or not. Context is sufficient to tell you. But as a rule, when we're forming our exercises, make it a habit to keep, you know, just put the F in and repeat it. That way you'll know you'll be okay. Hey, lesson five. Any other questions on those before we move on? I don't want to rush too fast here. Okay. The prepositions b, l, and k, these inseparable prepositions, gives more information on the forms of those. First, the form of these three prepositions is determined by the first consonant or syllable of the word to which they are prefixed. Part A, if the noun begins with the syllable y, yod, shua, the anticipated forms b, y, l, y, k, y are replaced by b, li, and ki. And this is just a manifestation of the rule of shua. In other words, you're not going to have two shuas in a row, and so instead something else happens. In this case, what happens is you get Hirik Yod in there. So that may be a little unusual too. But in a certain respect, it's not, because normally you would have gotten Hirik anyway, and the Yod was the first letter of the word, and so it just combines to form this mater. So you can kind of think of it as just an example of rule of Shawa, except that now we form a mater out of the Hirik Yod instead of having them both independent. So Yerushalayim becomes Birushalayim, Lirushalayim, Kirushalayim, for example. Yes?
In a sense, since the all the vowel points were given later, it's really artificial, because if you put that Shawa there, it's just a closed syllable ending on silent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in other words, they just dropped it as not being necessary and called it modern.
Yeah, you can think of it doing that too, and just call it that.
Any other reason to think of it any other way? I mean,
I don't think so. That's what I would rather, in order to get consistency with what happens elsewhere, I think it might be better just to think of this is just rule shawa. The thing became a hirik, and like you say, since it's a closed syllable anyway, or, you know, they just let the shua off, and we got a modern problem. Okay?
The pronunciation would be the same.
Yeah, it would have to be. You'd probably hurt yourself if you tried to pronounce it anyway. You know, it wouldn't be Yerushalayim. You know, that would be real. That's very un-Hebrew. Okay. Then, it seems like whenever they can make a matter, they do, especially with Yod's. You know, they just run them together. Now, B, if the noun begins with any other consonant followed by Shua, the prepositions have the vowel hirik. So here's the situation elsewhere. If it's any other consonant begin followed by Shua, then you're just going to have the rule of Shua as we've known it, and you'll just get hirik in the first syllable and a silent Shua, and it'll close the syllable. So Shemuel becomes Bishmuel, Lishmuel, Lishmuel, Kishmuel, Muel. So note that the Shua of the noun is dropped in pronunciation. Of course, this just means a silent Shua. And that's because of the closed syllable. If you remember your sounds and spelling rules, you see, then you understand why that's the case. It's a lot easier for us to go through this now. I can remember when we went through it the first time, and, you know, how, why, you know, because you hadn't had the experience with it. Now, having had the experience with it over and over again and being reminded that you go through it again, that's one of the benefits of going through it from the beginning again. You kind of see, oh, that's what that was all about, you know. You project yourself into your frame of mind the first time you went through this. I can assure you we took a lot longer on these chapters. I can remember having to say it 1,000 different ways almost. Okay, if the noun begins with a guttural followed by a reduced vowel, the prepositions have the corresponding full short vowel. That again is just rule of Shua. It's the rule of Shua when you're dealing with the reduced vowel form instead of a Shua, and you get the full vowel corresponding to the short vowel. The reduced vowel that you have. So chalom becomes ba chalom with a full patak. La chalom, ka chalom, etc. Onia, where you have a chatef kamatz chatuf, becomes bo onia, a full kamatz chatuf. Still a kamatz chatuf, but it's a full one. Then emeth, chatef segol, becomes bet emeth with a full segol just before it there. Okay, so that's just rule of Shua. Then part D, before words stressed on the first syllable, thus mainly monosyllabic words, the prepositions are optionally vocalized with pathak. Instances of this rather restricted form will be noted as they occur. So I think we may have run into a few places like that, but they're not very common. As we have stated previously, these three prepositions combine with a definite article, which loses its initial hey. The vowel of the article remains unchanged. So again, we just extend what we looked at before. When you want to have the article in addition to having one of these prepositions on, you form the article just as it would be required according to the rules, and then just pull the hay off and put the lamas in or the bait or whatever it is, and that will give you what you need. Okay, then aside from the special circumstances given in the preceding paragraphs, the prepositions simply occur as b, l, and k. So if you've got an anarthrous noun or something and you don't have any complications as far as rule of Shua, doesn't have a Shua in the first syllable, then it'll just be a b stuck onto it. Le'ir, k'melech, le'ish, so forth. All right. Preposition min. Yes, John?
You can take, for example, ba'onia.
Mm-hmm.
If we made that in a D shift, would it be ba'onia?
Let's see here. Yes, with an aleph. Yeah, it'd be ba'onia. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this one, and it wouldn't look much different here. It'd be the difference between the kamas chatuf and the full kamas, because with the aleph, what you'd just be doing, all you'd be doing is sticking on the ha'onia. Yeah, you'd have a metheg on it. That would tell you. But if you didn't have vowel points, you wouldn't be even worried about it anyway. You'd just be going by context. But the pronunciation is different, you know, ba'onia versus ba'onia, and the metheg would make the difference. Yes, Eric?
HMD, here on page 23.
Mm-hmm.
That the prepositions have a comma. Do you think that could have a relationship also to page 12 here with the monosyllabic noun?
Oh, yes.
Sometimes, and a comma where they,
right,
according to the rules, they wouldn't really have one.
Right. Yes, I think it's related to it. I've never seen anybody put a systematic thing together as to, you know, putting all these things together. See, remember, there's also something when we got to some of those short forms of the infinitive constructs, infinitives, and so forth, where sometimes they have the lambdas of the comets, and you couldn't figure out why there was a little rule at the bottom that says sometimes it's with the comets. Yeah, I think that may fall into the same kind of a category too. That there's, you know, when you get real short monosyllabic types of things, they seem to want to almost put some more beef on it, you know, a little bit more sound to it. And it might be interesting just to make some observations along with those lines as to what kind of a common pattern we might see to all of these various instances. We've kind of learned them as disjointed, you know, things that we had to remember. There may be some commonality to it. Yeah, that would be interesting. One of those big projects, you know, that it would take a lot of work, and you're not so sure it would be all that exciting once you got, even if you proved it, you know. You have to make some judgments on that. We can find all kinds of projects to do, but then you have to say, is this really worth the time and the effort? That's probably what all these grammarians decided. That's why they just left it as it was. Okay, any other questions on that before we get to min? All right. Preposition min, it's kind of a hybrid in a way. It's inseparable and acts like a, it acts like a separable preposition, a separate one by itself, but in some instances it can also be joined and shortened and become part of the word. So, first of all, part A. Before the definite article, this preposition may have either the form may, which is joined directly to the following word, which would make it like the and le and so forth in that respect, or min, which is usually joined to the following words with makay. So you can either have a separate word min, or you can stick it right on as may. Now this is before an articular noun, one that has the article. So you can have either min ha-melek or may ha-melek. So you'll see both of those, meaning would be the same. Then B, before nouns begin with a guttural or resh, the preposition takes the form may, joined directly. So if you've got something with a guttural on it, or resh, then they just put may on it, and you get ear would be may ear, rosh would be may rosh, using the teri there in the inseparable form. Then, before all other nouns, the form mith plus the doubling of the first consonant. Now it becomes a little bit more apparent why the previous one was may on gutturals, because gutturals can't be doubled. In other words, your normal pattern would be to want to put myth plus the doubling, but because you can't do that on a guttural, what's actually happened is a compensatory lengthening. And if you think of it that way, I think it might help give some consistency to this. I would rather, we didn't know much of that at the point that we went through this first, so it probably didn't matter which order it was taken in. But you might even reverse in your mind the order of these things. Think of it as myth plus the doubling of the first consonant, except when there's a guttural, in which case you use compensatory lengthening. You can't double, so you put two dots down there instead, and you get compensatory lengthening. I think that might be a better way to think of it. That way you can keep it somewhat parallel to what you did with the article. And even up there with the part A, the may form, when it goes on the article, it could be considered just a case of the same thing. The article hey can't take dagesh, and so you just put may on it, or just put min. So that kind of give you a consistent flow to the whole thing, maybe help remember it. So before all the other nouns, this form is min plus the doubling of the first consonant. So min melek, for example, and you double the name, and that would be from a king. Then the sequence miyeh is commonly contracted to mi, as in mi Yehuda for mi Yehuda. That's the same kind of thing. They just don't like to have for some reason, yod with a vocal schwa. And so it just becomes mihuda. And that's just a contraction. It's a common contraction. Then the comparative. I think this one of the most interesting features of Hebrew is the way they give comparatives. And having covered min now, we'll see that min is used not only as a preposition, but it's also used in a special construction to show comparison. So the adjective is not altered to inform express the comparative. That's nice. In Greek, you have to deal with another situation, you know, where the adjective is, you've got the comparative form and the superlative form, you've got different endings on them. But in Hebrew, there's no inflectional change. Instead, the preposition min is used before the noun, which is the basis of the comparison. So here's our example here. Ha'ish ha'cham meha na'ar. The man is wiser than the boy. So literally, this would be the man is wise from the boy. And so you see the way they're setting up their comparison. They're using the preposition min to indicate a separation in degree, one from the other. And it's very, very logical type of idiom. Once you are familiar with Hebrew, it really makes sense to say it this way. So on the comparison degrees, as it were, the man is wiser than the boy. If you were looking at a line of wisdom, here's point zero, here's 0 units of wisdom, and here's 12 units of wisdom that the little boy has, and here's 98 units of wisdom that the man has. You might say the man is wise from the boy. You know, he's further down the line. He's gone down from that point to another point of wisdom. That's the way I think of it anyway. Now, other sentence orders are possible and not unusual. In other words, orders of the sentences. Yafa ha'isha meha na'ara. The woman is more beautiful than the girl. Okay, in this case, since it's a predicate position for the adjective can be out in front too, and that's what happened in this case. The same construction may be translated two or four, you know, two, four. In other words, this is two such and such for such and such. It's still a comparison, but it's got a little bit different features, at least as far as English. In Hebrew, the constructions are the same, but in English, just because of the nature of particular words in our idioms, we may translate it this way. This has nothing to do with an inconsistency in the Hebrew structure. The structure of Hebrew is just the same, and they're thinking of it just the same, I'm sure. But in English, because the way we express comparatives is a little bit different and varies, we may use these two different ways to describe it, whichever fits the best to our language. So, in other words, we would probably not say, well, we might be able to say more difficult. The work is more difficult than the man could handle, or something like that. But we wouldn't say the work is more difficult for the man, is more difficult than the man, or something. That wouldn't make sense to us. So we would say the work is too hard for the man, too difficult for the man. So we kind of have to just decide. It says the choice between the comparative and two translations depends on which makes better sense. You just have to decide in English what's going to make sense in English. But in Hebrew, the constructions are just the same. Okay, then we were introduced to the relative word asher. And that's a word that gets a tremendous amount of mileage in Hebrew, too. That's one of the most widely used words. It'd be interesting to get the concordant, Hebrew concordance, see if they list how many times that word is used. I'm sure it's a multitude. But unlike English, the prepositional phrase in Hebrew does not commonly stand next to a noun as a modifier. They don't like to use prepositional phrases modifying nouns as in attributive position. So that's why we may speak of the book on the table or the fountain in the park, where on the table and in the park modify book and fountain respectively. In Hebrew, such modification more frequently introduced by the word asher, which usually is the equivalent of the English relative pronouns who, which, or that. So in Hebrew, you won't say the book on the table by just putting the word book and then the phrase, prepositional phrase, on the table next to each other. Instead, you'll say the book which is on the table, and you'll use asher. And the asher will enable a prepositional phrase to modify a noun, but the prepositional phrase will not modify a noun directly. That's another reason why, back in the example that we mentioned earlier, I think they talked about, they gave an adjective and a noun, and then a prepositional phrase modifying the adjective. Another reason you can tell it modifies the adjective is because there's no asher. If it was trying to modify the noun, then you'd have to use an asher in order to make the adjective, the prepositional phrase, modify that noun. At least normally. There are some exceptions to it, so you couldn't be absolutely certain, but that's generally the case. So let's look at these examples again, just to remind ourselves of this. And this is an important thing, because we get a lot of other asher things later on, and it might be easy to get this obscured. Ha'ish asher ba'ir, the man in the city, or the man who is in the city. So you don't just say ha'ish ba'ir if you want to make it attributive. You could say ha'ish ba'ir, but what would you be saying? You'd probably be saying, well, let's see.
The man is in the city.
Yeah, right. You may be making a predication. The man is in the city. And you can use a prepositional phrase in a predicate position. So if you want to say the man who is in the city, you'll need to use asher. Ha'ish asher ba'ir. And then, of course, that wouldn't be a full sentence. You'd have a verb and other things following. Okay, ha'am asher ba'aretz, the people in the land. Or the people which is in the land. Now, the word asher is not affected by the gender or number of the antecedent. So asher is an undeclinable word. You don't have a feminine form and a masculine form, or a singular and plural distinction. It's just asher for everything. So that's nice. So, for example, you have Ha'isha Asher Bahekal, the woman in the temple. Even though woman is feminine, Asher doesn't get a comma T on the end or something in order to change. It's just the same form. Okay. Another point here. Asher is not commonly employed before adjectives or participles. Thus, the man who is wise is simply Ha'ish Hechacham, or Hechacham all by itself, the wise man, the wise one, or the man who is sitting, Ha'ish HaYoshev. You don't say Ha'ish Asher HaYoshev, you know. It's not commonly done. So, in general, what we can say is that if we want a prepositional phrase to modify a noun, we need to use Asher. If we want something else to modify a noun, either a normal adjective or a participle, then we won't use Asher. Okay, the participle may be used alone even without the definite article as an equivalent of English one who, anyone who, whoever, he who. And that's basically simply another example of a substantive. Holeich be'emeth, he who walks in truth, or whoever walks in truth, or one who walks in truth. That's the idea. Or actually probably wouldn't be the one, it'd be, since it's San Arthur, it would be one who walks in truth. Okay, any questions there? Anything that doesn't make sense or didn't you don't fully remember or doesn't fit together? Don't forget that Asher thing and the way that you need to stick a prepositional phrase onto a noun. Okay, we have a few minutes left, so I think we can do another chapter here. We can do a chapter in 5 minutes, easy. We'll see. Okay. Chapter 6, noun plurals continued, some more of them. There are in general two types of monosyllabic nouns in terms of changes in the plural stem. A, those with no change. B, those having doubling of the final consonant. So here we see that same kind of doubling again that we saw with adjectives back a few chapters back. So we've got two kinds here, and you just have to basically learn which is which. I don't know if there's any real shortcuts. They've got some particulars here, but if by the time you go through this list of the points, it's probably easier just to memorize which is which. I think we remember this from going through. But looking at the examples, we've got shir, meaning song, shirim, sus, meaning horse, susim, oath, meaning sign, oath, dam, meaning blood, damim, etc. Those are monosyllabic nouns, and there's really no change in the stem. Then you get to the section B here. We've got am, that becomes amim, you get a doubling of the main. Chetz becomes chetzim, you get a doubling of the sade, but also a change of the vowel. And chok becomes chukim, and you get not only a doubling of the kof, but also a change to kibbutz. And so some of these are best just remembered as irregular ones and learn them that way, because you've got some criterion to go through here. You can, number one, the nouns with stem vowels, shurik, hirik, yod, holom, wow, and usually comments do not alter the stem before the plural ending. Two, nouns with stem vowel, seri, even one of two ways, the stem is unchanged, as in eights and eightsim, or B, the final consonant stem is doubled and seri is replaced by hirik, so become kreitz and chitzim. Then thirdly, nouns with pafak are similar to the above. When the final stem consonant is a guttural or resh, the stem vowel is lengthened and becomes to a comets and so forth. Otherwise, the final stem is doubled and the stem vowel remains the same as an amim. Those are good observations, but I don't think I would take the time to try to memorize those as criterion for judging things, because you're going to find too many exceptions, and I think it's best just to look at those as some observations maybe that might help tip you off, but you can't really rely on those as a regular pattern. Then we find the fourth category here, nouns with a stem vowel. Cholam usually follow the pattern of chok and chukim. Often, however, cholam is a defective writing for cholam wow, so that care must be taken not to confuse the type chok with that of oath in group A. In other words, if it's a cholam wow, it's not going to shorten. So you've got to be careful. Sometimes a word you're looking at may be a defective form of the actual form having a cholam wow, in which case it wouldn't change. So those things, there's no way to really know until you see them in the dictionaries or seem in the text and so forth. It says, because of irregularities and minor unpredictable deviations, the plurals will be given with the singulars in the vocabularies. The following nouns are irregular in that the plural stems do not conform to the types just enumerated. So, you know, you've got so many, he's even listed as many irregular ones here as almost as the regular ones he had. So after a while you wonder what's the use if you're really trying to set up rigid patterns anyway. And I wouldn't burden my memory load with trying to do that. Probably, since you have to learn the vocabulary anyway, you might as well just learn the vocabulary. So Rosh becomes Rashim, For example, Yom becomes Yamim, Bain becomes Banim, Yir becomes Arim, and Ish becomes Anashim. So those are all exceptions to everything that's just been said. Participles, a few more statements here. When the second or third consonant of a verbal root is a guttural, in other words, either an aleph, an ayin, a hay, or a kaf, the forms of the participle are slightly modified, and this is just in accordance with our normal problem with gutturals. So if the second consonant is a guttural, basically all that you find is you get a kamas, you get a reduced pathak instead of the shua in the plural form. So we have so ek becomes so akim and so akoth, but still becomes, it stays so eketh in the segalit form. And then when the third consonant is an ayin or a chayth, the feminine singular has pathak instead of segol in the last two syllables. So if their third consonant, your final consonant, is an ayin or a chayth, and those are the places where we saw before, usually those are the ones where you get patak furtive, like in the, boreach. Then it's going to get a patak pattern instead of segalit pattern, so it'll be borachath instead of borecheth, as you might have expected. Other than that, everything's pretty straightforward. When the third consonant is aleph, which is not pronounced when it would be a closed syllable, the feminine singular has a tseri. So when you have an aleph there, it quiesces and you lengthen to a tseri and just have one syllable instead of the two. Okay, that's all for today. We'll continue next. Let's see, we don't have class on Friday, do we? So next Tuesday we'll march on with this review. Sure goes faster when you don't stop for the exercise. But you may find, I don't know, you may find that you might want to look at a few of your exercises again and see if you remember how to do them. And if you want, you can go ahead and erase the answers and try them again or something. It depends on how much time you have. I wouldn't try to spend a whole lot of time on it unless you're having real trouble remembering. Because we'll have plenty of work to do before too long.
How can you tell if you remember or not?
Huh?
How can you tell if you remember or not?
Yeah, that's a good point. You could tell by covering up the answer and then trying to do it from memory.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some of those later exercises where I didn't have you do all of them, you could do some of the, because they didn't give you the answers for me, just so you couldn't check it.
You need to get some feedback.
Second, I'm not sure what the third would be, but the second future is just like a second aorist in effect. It's the ones that okay. Is that like oida and so forth?
They call it.
That's probably what happened there. Several people have been confused by that terminology because most of the other books don't use that.
They just talk about an irregular form. So I think that's the first effect there. And the same kind of thing happens with
That's right, we need another one. I'm going to have to...
Well, I still have to donate the one I have.
Yeah, I'm going to have to... They told me before they'd do it, but they probably just didn't get it down on paper and get it done. I should have done that in operation when I was working in operations.
Ah, that's right. Yeah, they clipped one.
You should have written it.
It's right here. I got it.
Right on work order myself for it.